Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Anlu Kiva. Anlu, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Nicholas. It is a gloomy, what day is it, Friday in Cape Town, but still smiling, so better, thank you.
Look, it's very difficult for a Friday to be gloomy, in my opinion, but...
Well, I'm a sunshine person, so I'd appreciate a bit of sun.
I'm very much not, never really seeing the sunlight, but so I'm continuing to try and make these Friday episodes a little bit different, a little bit have a slightly different vibe to some of the week ones. You know, in the Daily Friend Wrap, which we do from Monday to Thursday, that come out at 5, we're very business, we try to get to the point. I'm hoping to make Friday a little bit more chatty. We used to have 3 guests on Fridays. I'm trying it out with 2 at the moment. So, you know, let us know in the comments what you think of that. We're just trying to make it a little bit more conversational, so that we can keep being interesting and entertaining, which is always an important combination to have. But that being said, what's going on today? Well, there's national dialogue stuff, and I think we'll get to that later in the show. But we've also got a sort of smorgasbord of various political stories to get to. So we're going to start off with our first one, which is that the car manufacturing industry, as anyone who's been following the news closely recently will know, has been under a lot of stress. Now, while much of the recent attention has focused on the industry being under stress due to the U.S. tariffs of around, I think it's 25% or 30% on U.S. On South African exports of cars manufactured here into the U.S., the industry has not been in a great way for a long time. Layoffs due to labor disputes, being outcompeted by foreign imports, various other problems. And so this has led to the automotive industry, some of their executives are calling for government to do more in terms of placing duties on imported cars and buckies. Currently, we do have tariffs on buckies and cars coming to the country of around 25%. The industry has, as leaders now, CEOs, calling for it to be increased to 30%. They complain that they are not able to compete with cars manufactured in places like China, where the government massively subsidizes car manufacturing. However, a very big competitor that's often not mentioned is India, which has been selling very large numbers of cars to South Africa. Some of these cars are brought in because we just don't manufacture that many cars here. So honestly, we can't actually produce that many for ourselves. But basically, the industry says that they may be forced to downsize even more aggressively than they already are if they don't get support in the form of tariff protection, essentially. Now, from my view, this is completely the wrong approach that the industry is taking. And Anlu, I'd like your thoughts on this. But my thought is a tariff barrier is really just like a sort of a band-aid on the problem. It's not a proper solution to the issue. The real issue here is that our businesses are not competitive. They are not competitive due to an incredibly bad policy environment. Everything from very restrictive labor laws, damaging labor relations where trade unions are extremely aggressive and extremely powerful, and you know, sometimes even violence in the labor industry, in the sort of labor negotiations, overregulation of various things, problems with municipal electricity supply and water. And we've seen stories of like that where factories struggle to, you know, just make their products because they don't have proper supply of electricity that is reliable and clean. So I think that this is just sort of trying to fix a symptom, that all you're going to do is create a, even if you put in these import barriers, it would create an inefficient industry that raised the cost of cars that were sold to South Africans. So in the end, to save this industry, ordinary South Africans would pay the cost, which is exactly the wrong way. We should be looking at making our businesses more competitive, not less competitive. Do you agree, Anlu? What's your thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, I agree. I think as with many other things that we obviously have in the country, same with our electricity issues, the risk should not be seen. The risk isn't the competition. Competition is actually the solution, in fact. And we constantly see this argument that competition will actually just damage the sector or damage the industry. But in fact, it's the continuing to have that kind of almost protective system or protective sector will actually lock in the inefficiency. And competition is actually what opens up the market, both for investment, for growth, for trade, and efficiency, which is one of the most important things, actually, when you want to run a sector and an industry that grows. Markets thrive on the fact that there are entities and other companies that actually are much more efficient than you are. It drives you to improve your own operations and to improve your own procedures and progress processes at which you produce. And by doing that and opening the market in this way, it allows you to innovate, to be more efficient, to offer your consumers a much more competitive price. And we know that South Africa's automotive industry is, well, it's the biggest manufacturing industry in the country. And about a third of all the value that's created in the manufacturing sector comes from the automotive sector and from making vehicles and all their parts, directly or indirectly from factories. And yeah, for this reason, we need our car industry and our automotive industry to be as efficient and as competitive as possible. And yeah, it is the case that imports in this instance perhaps is putting a bit more competition in the market, but opening it up, or at least restricting it, is certainly not the solution.
And, you know, there is a cost, of course, to protecting those jobs, which is that ordinary South Africans who are already under enormous price pressure, particularly the sort of kind of insecure middle class, we might call it, people who are in the middle class but not very firmly, a car purchase for people like that is really important and really a big deal, right? It's a big part of their expenses. If you now say, okay, we're going to make sure that we're protected from all these cheap cars coming from overseas, you're just raising their cost of living, which is, you know, you may be helping the relatively small group of people, although it's still a significant group of people who actually have the car manufacturing jobs, but you're hurting all of those people. So, you know, there are trade-offs here, and I think that's not considered properly by the industry. In fact, we wouldn't be so desperate to maintain these manufacturing jobs if we had a more competitive and growing economy overall. The only reason that this is such a catastrophe that we might lose all these jobs is because we know that almost every one of those manufacturing workers is not going to be able to actually find other employment because the economy just isn't able to absorb them. And that is the real tragedy. It's the sort of larger environment this is in, rather than this specific tariff on us. This is a government failure that looks like it's resulting from like bad tariff luck or something like that. I don't know if you have any final thoughts on this one before we move on.
Yeah, I think we often, and especially on this platform, we talk about the consequences of something like BEE on the market. And when you actually go and have a look at the automotive production development plan, if you look at the plan before 2021 and when it was reproduced or repackaged, as they often do, after 2021, one of the specific things that has changed is that before there was no BEE compliance regulations on these manufacturing companies, automotive manufacturing companies, and afterwards they were. And this is one of those small instances where policy creeps in, or at least one of those very specific instances where policy creeps into the market and negatively affects it at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, exactly. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this one is very, very dark and very sad. I'm sure, though, we can still learn some interesting things about it. The Northwest government is the sole shareholder of a state-owned bus company, or a number of bus state-owned bus companies, Northwest Transport Investment, Northwest Star, and Attridgeville Bus Service, which operate in the province. However, these businesses all ran into huge financial problems and then were placed in business rescue in 2022, possibly due to or for alleged serious mismanagement and possible criminal financial irregularities. There have been a number of legal disputes and problems that have grown in those companies since they've been placed in business rescue. Their debt has gone from 355 million rand cumulatively to a billion rand, which is, you know, a crazy increase. And the result is that the employees of this company for the past couple of months have not been paid. Now, there's further legal disputes as 1,500 employees' families are challenging the lack of payment in court. Speaking to the media, one of the people whose husband is a bus driver said, "I never imagined having to write something like this, but we've reached the end of the road. We are no longer just struggling. We are completely broken, and we have lost all the hope that we can ever have. My husband has not received his salary for months, and your internal fights and delays are costing families like mine their dignity, their sanity, and their lives. While business rescue process is ongoing and the battle between old and new practitioners continue, we, the families, are dying slowly." The families of these employees allege that 14 of the employees have killed themselves since this basically lack of payment started. And that one person even possibly died due to not being able to afford food. So just absolutely horrific mismanagement. And, you know, if ever there was a reason to just junk some of these state-owned assets, I mean, this kind of seems like a fair case of that, which is that we need to, you know, just sell this off to someone who can actually do the job properly. Keeping it in limbo, keeping it sort of tied to the state, having it in business rescue, trying to salvage a broken situation. I don't know. It's just very frustrating to watch a story like this.
Yeah, no, I really, the story, it touched my heart, and perhaps I'm a little bit sensitive to these kind of stories still, but I believe many other South Africans have in fact been desensitized a little bit, and that should not be the case. We should still be very much worried when stories like this surface, and it should be treated with a necessary urgency as well, because these people are obviously, as she explained in the story as well, they've for months on end have not received salaries. And we know that many South Africans are living day to day, month to month, but in many instances, even day to day. So if you don't go to work today and you don't get your money for today, you essentially don't have something to eat tonight. And unfortunately, that is the case.
This once again ties back into this larger problem. I mean, you know, many other countries in the world, if you weren't paid for a few months, you'd quit the job. You'd be like, well, what's the point? But these people know that they're not going to be able to get another job. And that is why they're trapped in this nightmare situation.
Yeah. And as part of it, I mean, if you don't get your salary, it's also a case that it's not you don't get your money, but your UIF is not paid. Your children, your medical aid contribution is not paid. So many of these people now actually have to go to state hospitals. And in one of the quotes that they have of her, and I want to quote her because this is her, or well, not directly, but bring up the quote because it's obviously a real issue for them, is that her husband doesn't want to go to a state hospital because he says it constantly reminds him of the fact that his family used to have medical aid. They used to be able to get private healthcare, and now they have to go to a state hospital. And even their school children's fees, obviously they're falling behind on that. They've lost their cars. So there's so many real world examples or consequences from inefficiency in government. We have to obviously deal with things like Home Affairs, which to their credit have been doing much better. But obviously you have to deal with so many government departments on a daily basis, and we see the inefficiency, but instances like this remind us that people are in between life and death as a result of these inefficiencies. And it isn't fine. It's not moral for government to put these people in such dire situations and positions. Think if you just, yeah, there's so many, obviously Cape Town, My City Bus, is a good example of a public-private partnership where they have these private busing companies operating the buses. And there's still, obviously, you want large transport systems, but outsource it. There's such a great opportunity to give the business and the assets or whatever, sell it to a company who can actually operate it efficiently. and prevent future instances like these.
Right, right. Yeah, this is really the cost of, and we, you know, we don't know for sure, but I'm sure if you began looking into the details of these businesses and who they're being sold to and who was put in management positions, you'd find politically connected caterers once again using the cover of a program like BEE or to basically take control of these industries and sort of, you know, run them into the ground. I think there's also another point here in that quote that you read out from one of the affected families about how you know, they used to be able to afford medical aid, and now the husband is too depressed to even go to a state hospital because, you know, it's just sort of jarring for him. This is, I think, what the ANC doesn't realize about NHI. You know, these are sort of kind of working class, low middle class people. These are the people who the ANC has relied on for support, you know, in elections. And now through NHI, you're basically saying to these people, oh, you know, this medical aid, which is so important to your sort of self-esteem that you literally get depressed if you can't afford it anymore. Yeah, but that's no longer going to be a thing. And I think that explains why when the ANC signed the NHI into law just before the previous election, their numbers started to go down, even though they thought this was going to be some sort of great populist policy that would win over the people of the country. So when people began to realize that, no, this is going to take away one of the few good things that, you know, many millions of South Africans have been able to acquire in recent years, that you know, this was no good. And I think this is sort of, the ANC doesn't really have an explanation for that, because they're still stuck in the mode of thinking that we're sort of some hyper-communist revolutionary country where the populace is demanding that we abolish capitalism every 5 minutes, which is just not true.
Yeah, no, completely untrue, or false, or whatever the word for that is. I think one of the things that particularly stood out to me is her way that she phrased that her husband hasn't received his salary for months, and that obviously it's because of these internal governmental and regulatory fights and delays, but that it's costing her and her family and families like theirs their dignity, their sanity, and their lives. And that is the consequence of these, whatever you want to call it, the government's misperception or deliberate misgovernance. And yeah, it's costing people their lives. And I think there's an important point to make. You said that these people are middle-class families, but I almost see it as this full circle where government sees, okay, you know what, we have these families. They obviously want to work for their own job. They want to work for their own money and their own livelihoods. They want to have autonomy. But then government is pushing them into a direction where they have to be more reliant on them for these services. And it's actually just, it's not what the average South African wants.
Yeah, no, exactly right. Okay, well, let's move on to our next story. And, you know, here I think I actually have a bit of praise for an ANC minister, which I don't often have, but I think this is a side in which the minister is on the right side. The Minister of Electricity and Energy, Minister Ramakgopa, has said that he has asked the Eskom board not to proceed with its legal case against the regulator's decision to license 5 additional electricity traders in 2024. So what happened, I can't actually remember if we talked about this on the show, so forgive me if I've been over this before, if you've heard me say this before, but basically the electricity regulator licensed a number of companies to begin actually selling electricity on the grid. This is one of the few reforms that government has actually undertaken during Cyril Ramaphosa's time as president. It's been long awaited that the distribution network would be opened up a bit for the selling of electricity for more competition, so that Eskom's monopoly would be broken. Eskom agreed with this for a very long time. However, it's now challenging this decision to license these electricity traders in court, saying, no, you see, they'll take all the good customers and they'll leave us with the ones who don't pay, and that'll make us even more financially insecure. Well, to that I say, guys, you had a long run where you were the monopoly. You had a long run where you were given enormous government bailouts. You had a long run where you were, you know, you were the only game in town for electricity, and it didn't work. we had load shedding. We've had nothing but sort of massive problems across the country with electricity supply since then. And just because Eskom is doing better now than it was a few years ago is not a reason to immediately reverse direction on this. And so Ramaphosa has said that the electricity sector reforms are irreversible. And that, as I said, he has asked Eskom board not to proceed with this legal case. So a rare instance, I think, in which the minister is definitely on the right side. What's your take on this, Andrew?
I thought I was muted for a second there. Yeah, I think it fits in perfectly with our analysis of the automotive sector as well, in the sense that competition won't damage the electricity supply and the electricity sector. And in fact, continuing to keep the monopoly that Eskom currently has is just locking in this inefficiency and the lack of investment, and obviously us potentially going back to a situation where we have load shedding almost every day. And I agree with you that in the long term, they've had a good, like, they've had a run at it. You clearly can't deliver, so step aside. And again, markets thrive on that competition because it drives efficiency and it drives innovation and better prices for the consumers. If you look at between when we had the electricity crisis, I think it started in 2007, am I correct? I think so. And between then and 2022,
electricity tariffs. At the tail end of the Becky presidency.
Yes, yeah. Electricity, like tariffs for electricity increased like fourfold. Much, much higher. And this is something like, I'm not talking about 50% as fourfold. I'm talking about 600%, a lot more. And opening the market to competition and getting the South African consumer the most reliable, most affordable electricity is in the public's interest. So yeah, if the government, I believe, kudos to the minister, it's government's responsibility to take decisive action to make sure that South Africans get the most affordable, the most reliable electricity. And the first step to this is obviously opening up the market.
Indeed, indeed. All right. I think let's do one more story for today. And this is, of course, that the it's been a little bit difficult to tell when the actual start date, as it is, of the national dialogue is. I mean, I've sort of, there was that initial thing where the eminent persons were all meeting and talking to the media, and they had a meeting, and then it's sort of been the series of meetings that's been kind of dripped out. But I guess today is supposed to be the sort of official start of the national dialogue, even though the process has kind of been ongoing for a few weeks. And as we've discussed on the show this week, you know, the whole thing seems to be kind of falling apart and lacking legitimacy as various groups drop out or refuse to attend. Us being the Institute of Race Relations, also were invited at the last minute and we decided not to attend. We published the reasons why on the dailyfriend.co.za. But all that said, it's quite incredible some of the viciousness that's being directed at the National Dialogue by the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, which has accused the organizers of the National Convention of, quote, unethical efforts to mislead the people. The foundation's chair, Geraldine Fraser Mulketi, said the event was not sanctioned by the official preparatory task team and the body overseeing the dialogue process, and that conveners have nothing whatsoever to do with the recognized national convention. With all due respect to those who are attending the forthcoming meeting at UNISA, these individuals have no possibility whatsoever to claim to represent any of the constituencies which we have referred and will be unable to engage meaningfully on the challenges of our country. It is exactly for obvious reasons that the meeting at UNISA cannot, as you claim, for some reason, mark the formal kickoff of an inclusive citizen-led process to chart a shared future for vision for South Africa's future. Pretty aggressive words. And I saw one of our viewers, Dirk, was watching the thing live at UNISA now that's going on, which is the sort of kickoff of the national dialogue. And he remarked, seeing Rolf Meyer and Cyril sitting next to each other shows that more than 30 years after Kodesa, we've not moved an inch as a country. Now, I think it's not entirely fair. I think many things have changed, but I think I very much take your point, which is that, particularly from, I think, Cyril Ramaphosa's perspective, There's a sense here in which he's trying to relive the glory days. He's trying to sort of recreate the magic that he felt perhaps when he was involved in the constitutional negotiations. He's trying to create some sort of legacy. He's like, this is like an attempt to make a second sort of like, I don't know what to call it, physical, emotional constitution that will lead the country forward and create a great legacy for him. And Andrew, you were struck by something our colleague Terence Corrigan wrote earlier this week. We'd like to elaborate on your thoughts.
Yeah, I particularly like Terence's way of framing it as obviously just Cyril trying to, I apologize if anybody can hear my dog barking, Cyril trying to obviously initiate this as him leaving a legacy after everything that he's failed in between. And yeah, there's a couple points here that stood out to me. Vincent Magwenya's, who's obviously now the spokesperson for the president, he said at the press briefing that they had yesterday that these foundations who obviously now decided to boycott, that they were never set up to be constituency groups as far as we understand them, he said, which is just, I found it hilarious. Obviously, they were good enough for you to invite them. They had big enough of a network. They had enough influence. They had enough standing for you to think that inviting them would add legitimacy and credibility to your national dialogue. But the moment they turned their backs, you are shifting the narrative to now delegitimize them. And you have just this entire shift of almost trying to now say that them boycotting the national dialogue is not any, it shouldn't put a question mark over the president's credibility. It's just that they just don't want what is best for South Africa. Yeah, I found it worrying. And when you obviously read between the lines, I think it just points to the fact that they are in a defensive position. They are trying to obviously, they thought that this is going to be the network that these agents or foundations bring is going to be an asset to them. And in fact, it turns out to be a point to much of their weakness. Yeah, and I wanted to before, in the before show, I mentioned to you also, this thing that Cyril does, and I'm going to be very like keen on looking this weekend to see if there's any, obviously, video of him, and I'm sure it will be live streamed since it is a national dialogue after all. I'm waiting to see Cyril do this little shrug of his. And I usually love listening to body language analysts and how they analyze what people do with their bodies and so. And I recently listened to one episode and this doctor was explaining how this shrug is immediately a sign of uncomfortableness and being just put into a corner. And every time he just does this and that little smile of his, which I find, very slimy, but so we'll keep an eye on it. But there's definitely, if you look at what they've been saying, it's not been an asset to them.
No, I think that's the case, and I think the ANC is still struggling to contend with the fact that it's not 2004 anymore. The economy is not growing like it was in 2004. Crime is not going down really like it was in 2004. You don't have the sort of sense of optimism. The ANC isn't this growing electoral force as it was in 2004 when it had almost gotten 70% of the vote in that election. The circumstances are completely different, and yet sort of the formula to try and fix things is the same. Oh, we're going to have a big convention where we try and create buzz and excitement and manufacture a mandate to keep doing what we're doing. And the thing that always comes home for me again and again is that Cyril Ramaphosa, I think, in 2017 really had a historic opportunity to change the direction of the country. He was very popular. He had won the ANC's internal conference, and he really could have begun to turn the party in a direction away from the path that it had been on. He could have said, look, we've tried this, super race nationalism, double down on the socialism stuff during the Zuma years. It made things worse. It opened the door for corruption. Now we need to, if we want to survive as a party, we need to keep moving forward. And if the ANC resisted, you could have said, well, do it without me then, because I'm the most popular person, president in the country, politician in the country. Good luck without me. And that would have been a powerful card to play. He didn't take that. He instead decided to keep massaging the party's ego, to keep all the factions on board, to not make anyone too upset. Remember how long it took him to fire Ace Magashule, despite the fact that as General Secretary, Ace Magashule was undermining him constantly and clearly aligned with Zuma. It didn't stop the ANC splitting anyway, because the MK party then proceeded to split off, meaning he didn't even achieve his objective of party unity. And now we sit, you know, years later with a legacy that is getting worse, I think, by the minute. And that for me is actually in many ways why I think Ramaphosa is this sort of great villain, is that he gets elected on this promise of reform in many ways. This is what makes him popular. And he squandered that opportunity completely and has turned himself into an even bigger failure. I mean, when Zuma came in, there was some talk of populist politics and all that, but I don't think anyone really expected that he was going to take the country in a super positive direction, unless you're one of his already ardent, you know, super diehard supporters. But anyway, Anlu, I've been monologuing, your thoughts.
Yeah, well, your monologues are usually very, very good, so thank you. Yeah, I think I particularly also liked what one of our colleagues, Marius Ruet, said in a press release that went out earlier today. And it echoes this idea that the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, Dr. John Endres, has also been saying, is that we don't need the national dialogue as an event. We saw in particularly that article that Vincent Magwenya said that this is not a once-off event. It will be a recurring dialogue and a recurring get-together almost. But we don't need another event to kind of raise that. It's not needed. We have parliament and we have the elections, and that's where it's supposed to happen. And I what I liked about Maurice's assessment is that it's clear from this that parliament is not seen as an important institution for us to discuss these social issues. It's clearly not the main stage where these type of discussions are held, and it should be. That's exactly why it's there. It should be considered as that. So yeah, well, I suppose have a busy weekend.
And you know who does have a constituency to represent particular views? The parties in parliament, which got elected in a massive election involving millions of people. It's so irritating to see this national dialogue thing, because it's just, this is the point. Yeah. We have a national dialogue forum, parliament. We're supposed to use it every day. Mm-hmm. We don't use it properly. And that's one of the reasons why we're in the mess that we're in.
But anyway. Exactly.
Before my blood pressure goes to the roof, let me, I think, release you and everyone else. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and we will see you next week. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. And keep strong, keep smiling, and we'll see you all on Monday. Cheers, everyone.